Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Food 360, the podcast that serves up some serious food for thought. I'm your host, Mark Murphy. Today, I'm excited to welcome Amanda Mutaki, an American expat living in Morocco. She's the owner of Marrakesh Food Tours and her successful website, MoroccoMama.com. Amanda, welcome to Food 360. Thank you so much for coming on to my podcast. And I also know you because I follow you on Instagram, and I know, well, everybody talks about you because the last time I saw you was when I was visiting Morocco, and you took us on an amazing food tour, and your Instagram name is MoroccoMama, which is, why did you come up with that name?
So Moroc means Morocco in French. And mama, because I was a mom. So I started my website long before Instagram was a thing. And it was the idea that I was the mom of Moroccan kids. But it was fun and it clicked and it was, you know, it sounded cute. And I don't know, I never really imagined that it would be what it is today, that it would have had this sort of like this longevity, because it's been like 13 years. Yeah, so that's how I came up with it, and then it stuck, and I had thought about changing it a while ago, and everyone's like, you can't change it, because that's what people know you as now, right. So
you live in Marrakesh. Give us a quick description of your city that you live in now.
Well, Marrakesh right now is a lot quieter than Marrakesh usually is, but normally Marrakesh is a crazy, crazy city. I don't know if I've ever been anywhere on Earth that quite has the same vibe as Marrakesh does. It's a total juxtaposition of like old and new. And in some places it feels like you've gone back in time hundreds of years. And in other places it's like, you're at a nightclub in Los Angeles or Las Vegas. Like it's just a very kind of strange combination of things. But I love it because all of that coexists and everybody kind of lives together and does their own thing. And nobody really cares what anybody else is doing. Like, you can still be friends if you're super religious, or if you're like out partying all the time, nobody really cares.
I mean, that's the great thing about Morocco, is it is sort of it's a great melting pot. I think everybody's there. I mean, I think even, was it true that doesn't 50 Cent even owns a hotel there or has a club? And I think Richard Branson's sister has a place there as well. I mean, it's basically a lot of people sort of end up in Marrakesh. It's interesting.
Yeah, that is very true. There's a lot of celebrities, and like just big names and all sorts of things that are here that have, you know, investments, or they live here part of the time. Yeah, it's just really become a place that people are drawn to. But it's still like, I feel like it hasn't really lost its soul yet. Hopefully it doesn't. Hopefully it keeps that.
It's been around a while. If it hasn't lost its soul yet, I think we're okay. I mean, it's amazing. I think obviously the history of Marrakesh, the history of Morocco is so deep and so long. We're obviously not going to get into all of that, because it's definitely, we could go on for hours about that. But, you know, describe to me like the markets there and what does that feel like? And tell me, do when I go there as a tourist, am I getting the same thing? Or am I eating and you know, acting the same way as obviously the locals do. I mean, you're a local there, so I mean, are the you're shopping at the same food markets?
I think that it depends on the Marrakesh experience you want to have, right? I think that for people who come as a tourist, it can be difficult to have a very local experience, right? Like the markets that I go and shop in my neighborhood, maybe you, Mark, would come and go shopping in that market. But for the average tourist, they're not getting there. You know, it's just too far off of the beaten path. Like you kind of have areas of Marrakesh that are where it's primarily locals, and then the other areas where tourists tend to go. And I think you see, like, especially with the idea of this like shared economy where people are spreading out a little bit more and getting into more residential areas when they come to visit. But yeah, the primary focus when people come is really in that kind of the Medina, the old area of Marrakesh. And there are still people that live there, that's their home, and they live there and they go to the markets there and everything. But most tourists don't tend to get beyond that. So if you were going to a local market here, what would you experience? I'm remembering the first time my mom came to visit because it was so overwhelming and different for her. So you have fruit and vegetable vendors selling out of carts, like wooden carts. You've got, you know, butchers that are butchering animals just in the open out of their shop, butchering chickens, and there's meat hanging from hooks. And, you know, it's basically the exact opposite of what you expect in like a Western grocery store where everything is nice and clean and packaged and presented to you nicely. But there's a real like earthy richness to that, right? Because everything is fresh. All of those vegetables, all of the fruit, they come every day from the farms outside of Marrakesh. You know, the butchers, well, it looks like there's this big slab of meat hanging and that's gross because you don't know how long it's been there. The butchers know how much they're going to sell. So they put out what they know that they're going to sell so that it doesn't go bad. So people just have like a much closer connection, I feel like, to the food than I ever had living in the U.S.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's obviously a great thing because you're obviously, you know, you're using what you get, and you're selling what they, you know, they sell exactly what they actually slaughter or whatever they bring to market. I think it's an important thing. I mean, and Marrakesh has been obviously known for its trade, and it over the centuries and years, it's, you know, so all of the trading going on there. And I think that one thing that you read about, and I want to sort of talk about, is the whole like sort of haggling of prices. It just seems to be every tour book or every guidebook and everything you hear about Morocco is you have to sort of, you know, you're supposed to sort of haggle. That's sort of, from what I understood, is sort of a tradition there and what it is. But it's so important when people travel. And I guess you probably encounter this a lot when you're giving tours and people haven't even done any research at all and don't know anything about anything. But it's so important to sort of get a little bit or understand a little bit of the flavor of the culture of a place before you get there. And can you describe that to me? Like sort of what is that sort of haggling tradition? And also, what are the things, if you're going to talk to people, they're going to come to Morocco the first time, what would you tell them the most important thing is before they get there, they have to understand, that they need to understand?
Okay. So, ooh, that's a loaded one. Okay. So for haggling, it's so outside of most people's comfort zones that come from a Western culture that I find it's something, yeah, you're right. Everybody really struggles with this. They don't know how to do it. They don't want to insult anyone. They don't want to feel like they're getting taken advantage of. They don't know what they should haggle for, what they shouldn't. So it's a whole layer of complexity. So my best advice is just relax, make it a game, make it fun, laugh about it. If you're laughing and you're having a good time, the sales guy is going to be laughing and having a good time, and it's going to just release so much of the pressure. And just being, I've seen different people, and people who are really anxious about it, it just ends really poorly. But a good rule of thumb for that, for if you are going to haggle, is you should cut it by at least half or more. And then the idea is you're going to meet somewhere in the middle. Like, you know, you're going to meet somewhere in that like 50 to 70% of the original price. But you don't haggle for things like bananas. You wouldn't haggle for bananas. or you wouldn't haggle for like eggs, you know, things like that, that are kind of like daily things. That's like the price is kind of the price. You could say like, oh, wow, that seems like a little bit expensive. And the guy might say, okay, I'll give it to you for like a little bit less, but then leave it at that. Like that's sort of the end of it. It's just him doing you a favor. But for like bigger purchases where you're, you know, if you were going to buy a piece of furniture or you were going to buy a rug or, you know, something that costs, that's more expensive, then you absolutely haggle.
I did want to just quickly jump in here because the credibility you have of why you know all these things, and I don't think I said it at the top, is you have a company called Marrakesh Food Tours. You and your husband, is that correct? So you are an official tour guide and a voice recognizing what is happening in Morocco. But go ahead. I'm sorry. So you're saying when you're buying furniture or rugs, that's when you haggle more?
Yeah. So like if it's a bigger price item, then you definitely do. And if you accept the price that the salesperson gives you, they will have no problem taking your money. But you might not feel so good parting with it. But it's definitely expected and you shouldn't feel bad about it. It's part of the game. Like I said, if you can make it into a game and you can like loosen up and just be lighthearted about it and also be okay walking away, you're not going to make anybody angry. Like they expect it, you know, it's not going to be the first time it's happened to them.
So they expect you to sort of haggle. And if you can't come up on a decision, they're okay with you walking away. They're like, okay, well, we'll get the next guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you shake hands, you say, hey, you know what? This is just not in my budget, or, you know, it's more than I want to spend. And you walk away. And sometimes they'll come out after you and they'll say, okay, all right, I'll take your price, your final price. Right. And you can decide if you want to go back and do that. And sometimes they don't, and that's fine. And it's got to be a win for
both
of you.
That's so funny. And that's sort of just the shopping sort of people need to know. What's the other main thing that people should know when they come to Morocco?
I think the other thing that I would tell people is just don't come with a preconceived notion of what it is. Because what I find happens a lot is that people have an idea in their mind of what Morocco is or what Morocco isn't, and then they're not really sure what to make of anything, right? So if you come with a very open mind to experience Morocco for what it is, I just feel like your experience is going to be very, very different than if you come expecting something like, I'll give an example. Like a lot of people think Morocco is extremely conservative or that it's a dry country. There's no alcohol here. Yeah, Morocco is a Muslim country primarily, but I would not say that it's an extremely conservative country. Like there's a thing with being respectful of the culture and the people. But if you're wearing a dress, you know, for a woman, for example, sorry, I can't speak for guys, but if you're a woman and you're wearing a dress out, like nobody's going to pelt you with stones. It's just not that way. It's very, it's very cosmopolitan in a lot of ways. And I think you just, just go with the understanding that there will be things you don't understand and it will be different, but just go with an open mind.
I mean, I felt definitely that way. I went with a group of people we were in Morocco for a little over a week, I think, about a year ago. And I felt the same thing. It's like, you just go with an open mind. They're definitely, the people are so accepting and people are just super nice. Everybody's nice. And I guess I've traveled a lot. So whenever I go somewhere, I always expect people to be nice because I mean, why wouldn't you? I mean, it's so much more difficult not to be nice, I find. But Morocco, I think that, and you will get into your a little bit of your background in a minute, but you're there, you have a tour company and you landed in this amazing place, but tourism is a huge part of the economy now. Is that correct? Because, you know, before I came to Morocco, I tried to do some research and I found some old travel books from like the 70s and things like that. And there was a lot of negative vibe in these books about being careful, about this, about that. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I might have heard this in Morocco, but I've been traveling, obviously I travel a lot, so I don't remember where I get everything from. But is it true that there's no word in Moroccan that says tourist? It's only the word that you're a guest of the kingdom? Is that true or am I making that up?
It could be. I mean, it sounds possible. I'm not fluent enough to know specifically if that is true or not. Now I'm very curious, though. I'm going to find out. But yeah, I guess I'm trying to think of what words people use when they refer to tourists. Usually it's not tourists. They might say like a foreigner, or they might say like a nationality.
But you don't, there's not a word for tourist in Morocco, is there? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I know it out there. Well, yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
We're learning new things.
That's just interesting.
I think one of our tour guides, when we were in the mountains, when we went up to the Atlas Mountains, I think he is the one who told us about that. So maybe, who knows? I mean, I love the idea, you know, not having the word tourist and you're a guest of the kingdom. It's like, it's so much more pleasant, you know?
Yeah. And I think most Moroccans look at it that way, that people are really seen as guests, and there's an extreme culture of hospitality that is lovely and charming and also difficult to understand as somebody who didn't grow up in this culture, and just how those two things kind of collide with the American culture I grew up in.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does optimism look like? I'm on a quest to find the people who inspire us to dream more and do more. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. I talk to all sorts of people, from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to a hairdresser on Instagram who gives out free haircuts to the homeless, from the CEOs of the world's largest companies to the comedy writer who visited the wreckage of the Titanic. I love talking to leaders, artists, authors, and eccentrics about life, leadership, purpose, mental fitness, human skills, high performance, and other curious things. It leaves me feeling wiser, more inspired, and, well, more optimistic. Because after all, this is a bit of optimism. The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look for it. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
What's super interesting to me, and obviously my podcast, we talk about everything about food, and you're very entrenched in that, but you're not the first person that I've encountered that this whole sort of food tourism is really catching on. When we go places, we look for people. I was in Istanbul. We found somebody who showed us around Istanbul, but just through the eyes of food. And so when did you decide to start this tour company with your husband? And do you mostly concentrate on food, or you obviously you might have to diversify and just do other stuff as well, but it's super, I don't know. I think I travel through my stomach, basically. I go and eat the countries, but that's how I do it. And it's really helpful to have people like you that are there that can show people around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same when I travel. And so I think that's really where it came from. Like, honestly, I don't really care if there's a great museum or whatever. I'm like, where can I get the best canafa? Or where can I get, like I just want to know where to eat. Like, just tell me that and maybe I'll see something else. So yeah, we moved here. We're finishing 7 years that we've been living in Morocco. And when we first moved here, we were both working from home, and we would go like to the square in Marrakesh and have like a coffee. So we'd sit in a cafe and we'd watch, because it's a great place to people watch. There's Moroccans, there's tourists, there's, you know, anything and everything is going on, and you can just kind of sit back and watch and see what's happening. And so, you know, we would make up little stories about what these people were doing, and it became this whole thing that my husband and I would do. And then it started to be where we would see them going into like certain places, and we'd be like, oh, like, don't go eat there. Like, you could go, if you just went like four more places away, it would be so much better. And And I was like, oh, it's just really, it's too bad because people asked me all the time where to go and eat. Like they'd ask for my blog, like, where can I go and eat in Marrakesh? But it's so hard to tell people where to go and eat unless it's like a proper restaurant, right? That has a name and a address and all of those things. But if you go into the Medina of Marrakesh, forget it. Like you're not going to find the places that I would tell you to go because there's no street names. Or they're very limited. It's just like a windy maze. There's no restaurants that are like labeled. And even if you did walk into places where I'd tell you to go, like you'd be like, this is not a restaurant. I'm not eating here. So we realized the only way that we could really get people to have this experience was to take them ourselves. So this was about 6 years ago, and we didn't really know what a food tour was at the time. We hadn't ever done one. But I happened to go to Madrid for something. I don't remember what. And I did a food tour in Madrid. And it was the first time I'd done one. Completely loved the idea. Came back to Marrakesh and told my husband, look, we don't have the capital to start a shop or any other kind of business. This is going to cost us almost nothing to start. I know how to build a website. I already have a built-in audience who's asking me how to do this. We know where to go and eat. We could totally do this. And he's like, it's never going to work because you're the only one who's a freak and likes to travel and eat. And that's all you care about. And I'm like, no. Like there's so many people like me that love to do this. And he's like, okay, fine. We can try it. And if it doesn't work, I was right. You were wrong. We'll chalk it up to that. I'm like, okay. And when it does work, I'm right. And I get to be right forever.
It sounds like a typical marriage. So that was typical marriage going on.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how it came to be. And we spent a couple, 2 months maybe going around picking out our favorite spots because, you know, they had to be places that we could walk to that had a story that they kind of built a cohesive sort of menu around. And we tried to pick places that my mom would never walk into because there was like no menu, no English. It was too like not restaurant-y. But places where my mother-in-law would go and eat. So that's kind of like our barometer of choosing a place. So it took about 2 months. I built a very basic web page, launched it, and like people were interested sort of right away. Like it wasn't like a rocket ship, but I mean, like it took off. And we were able to really build out a company with what started as maybe we'll run two tours a week or a tour.
And obviously before the lockdown, so to speak, how many tours a week were you doing?
We were running about 12 to 14. A week.
Wow. Because, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of tourism in Morocco, right? Is that it's a huge, huge part of the country, which obviously the country's not, you know, it must be difficult right now. We'll get to what's happening now and what the future looks like in a bit. But so you picked up your, now let's go back. You met your husband in Morocco. You guys got married. I know there was a great story there, but then you lived in America for a while and then you guys moved back. What was that like being an American and patriating and going and becoming living in Morocco, like was it, and now you're raising three children there as well. Was it the bureaucracy? Is it like every other country? I mean, you know, you got to go get your paperwork and do this. What was the transition like for you?
It was, our plan was we were going to come for 1 year and we had our two older kids. They were 6 and 8 when we moved and they were going to learn Arabic and French in 1 year. That was our plan. Small goals. And like 6 months into it, we realized they weren't that bright. No, I'm just kidding. We realized that it was just going to take them longer. And so we decided we would stay longer and then we started the company and everything. And we're still here. But what was hard was language was the hardest thing for me. So I was always extremely independent and I am extremely independent. But being put into a foreign country where you don't speak the language is very isolating. And it took me a long time to even get up enough courage. Even if I understood what was going on, it takes a long time to get not afraid to talk and not to be misunderstood, I feel like. So it really took me like 2 years to feel comfortable here, comfortable enough to like go out, do my own thing, do my own shopping, like to be completely independent where I didn't really need anybody. I think that was the hardest part. Everything else, I mean, I'm a fairly flexible, adaptable person, so it wasn't so huge. But like, just the language and the loss of my independence was really, really tough.
And where were you born originally? Where's your family from?
Yeah, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And now you live in Marrakesh, in Morocco. It's the difference in cultures. I mean, it's like you explained it
huge.
Earlier. When your mother comes to visit, she's like, okay, we're going to eat where, right? You have those that culture difference. And what is it like raising your children in this? I mean, do they come back and forth? Do they come back to America and then go back? And what is it like for you guys?
Yeah, so we do usually come back in the summertime, which is the best time to go to Michigan when there's not snow and it's not negative 50 degrees. So we usually spend the summers in the States and then the rest of the year here. And they, you know, it's hard because they're teenagers now. So it's like teenagers are weird anyway, and they're hard to read. So sometimes they're fine with it and sometimes they really want to go back. And I know my oldest son is looking at universities now. And so he's like, nope, I'm going back to the US. I'm American. I'm going back to America. But I think from a parent's point of view, I feel like they're better rounded people for having had this experience, like that they have a broader outlook on the world than they would have had if we had stayed in the US. And as much as they feel like, I feel like they will have some identity issues with what are they, where do they fit, what does that look like? I feel like as they become adults, they'll get an understanding of that, and they'll be able to, you know, they'll be able to make their own choices because they will have had both experiences. So hopefully it works out that way. And they're trilingual now. So please, someday they should thank me for this.
And what, as you said, it took you 2 years to learn to learn how to speak Arabic, but there's a different dialect in Marrakesh as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Moroccan Arabic is its own dialect of the Arabic language. And it's very different than, say, for example, Jordanian Arabic or Iraqi or from the broader Middle East. So it's not super usable outside of this region, sort of Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. But in school, the kids learn classical Arabic. So Moroccans can understand like classical Arabic, no problem. It's just nobody can really understand them when they speak their language. They can understand everybody else. Nobody can understand them.
I've got you. So let's talk about the food. Let's talk about the actual food in Morocco. So first of all, there's all sorts of cooking going on in tagines. And there's, I of course, as soon as I got back from Morocco, bought tagines. And then I proceeded to put way too much stuff in it and trying to cook it and really messed it up my first time. I'm getting better. I realize it needs a lot more space and it's got to cook obviously slowly, but it needs more space to cook. So I'm getting there. But I've done it again and I've done it better. But let's talk about some of the traditional dishes of Morocco and what is the most popular dish in Morocco.
Okay, so I think this is where the whole tourist and local divide kind of comes in. So for locals, the traditional Moroccan diet is very heavy in vegetables and grains, and meat was something that was extra if you could afford it. So today, what you see if you come as a tourist is a lot of meat, maybe some vegetables, and, well, of course, lots of bread. So it's shifting a little bit. And as Morocco does better, like economically, you see more meat coming into the diet, more processed foods, more takeout, more things like that. I think one of the like classic Moroccan dishes is chicken tagine with preserved lemons and olives, which you'll find on literally every menu that you can come across when you come to visit. And, you know, it's very simple, very classic, very delicious. And I think another... another one would be maybe couscous, which is very popular, which is like a steamed semolina grains with vegetables, and usually lamb is like the most traditional. It's made with lamb. Those would be two really popular, well-known dishes that every Moroccan in any corner of the country is going to eat. And then in Marrakesh, we have tangia, which is not tagine. And it's just really slow cooked lamb that's cooked in a clay pot in the coals of a fire for like all night, 12 hours, 14 hours, really long time, with preserved lemons and garlic and saffron, cumin. Very simple, but comes out delicious. It's like the original slow cooker meal.
It's like the crock pot, right, of Morocco. I mean, I really, the preserved lemon is one of those things that's just so classically Moroccan. I, of course, I make them myself now, and I have a big jar of it, and I love using it. But I know that you can also use it too much. It can really overtake a dish. So it's really just a small hint in the background of a dish. But they're basically lemons that you use salt and you stick them in a jar, basically, and leave them for a couple months, and then they're just, you know, that's preserved lemons. Do you make your own or do you buy them?
No, I do make them and I buy them. I mean, it's hard. When I lived in the States, I made them all the time. But when you have them here and they're so easy and accessible, it's hard sometimes not to just buy them. But yeah, they're super, super easy to make. And I think there is a tradition too of like preserving things because it's an arid climate. So anything that you want to last longer than a few days when there was no refrigeration had to be preserved. So, you know, preserving lemons was a way to make them last longer. I have a cookbook that's Jewish Moroccan cooking, and they have like preserved kumquats. Ooh. And yeah, just like all these other, you know, things that they used. And the meat, I don't know if you tried this when you were here. You did. I think I did. The clair, which is like the lamb that's been preserved and stored in lamb fat, and then it's cooked with eggs. Yeah. Or it could be in couscous. Sometimes they put it in couscous.
And that's for breakfast, right? Usually?
Yeah. Usually it's eaten for breakfast, but yeah, you could put it in couscous too. Sometimes if people don't have fresh meat, they might use that if they want to add some meat to it.
Well, it is amazing that, I mean, the Moroccan diet, I think, as you're saying, is so much heavier on vegetables. And I think that's the way people, you know, probably it's a much healthier diet, obviously, to be able to do that. It's a healthier way to live is to eat, you know, less meat and more vegetables is good. The only thing that always gets me in Morocco is that tea. I mean, your teeth fall out when you taste it. There's so much sugar in it, I find. It's like you're getting really good vegetables and all that, but the mint tea, I always find, and it's so, so strong and obviously with the mint, but also the sugar content is quite high. And you took us to a great sort of tea tasting. This is just one of the things that you do on your tour, I guess. We stopped into this restaurant and we had all these different teas. And I'm trying to remember one of them that I really liked. And it was like, I can't remember what was it. Can you just describe the tradition of tea and the different teas in Morocco?
Yeah, sure. So the most traditional is mint tea, of course, and mint is everywhere and it's so cheap here. Like I can't even, when I go back to the US, I just want to die with how expensive it is. And the reason, so do you know the reason? I think I told you guys, but the reason why it's so sweet is that sugar is a sign of wealth. So sugar was something that was, you know, sometimes it was worth more than gold because it was something that was just very difficult to get. And so if you're served tea without sugar, it's a subtle way for someone to tell you you're not welcome.
Oh, well, isn't that nice? That's throwing some shade, huh?
Yes. Yeah. So, they're so hospitable. They're not going to say like, oh, I'm sorry, I have an appointment in a half an hour. Like, can you come back later? They'll just make the tea with no sugar. And then you understand that, oh, this person actually like has something that they need to do. So it's a way for you not to offend anyone, sort of subtly. So if you get a lot of sugar, it means that they really like you. And if you get no sugar, it means it's time to go home. and hopefully it's something in between, right? Yeah. So this is a way, tea is like, also drinking tea is a way of inviting someone to your family. So like when my husband and I got married, we don't drink alcohol. So we didn't have a champagne toast. Instead, we had teacups brought from Morocco for everyone, and we like explained to them the tradition, and then we drank tea with everyone as a way of welcoming them as a part of our new family. So it's just kind of it's got a really nice a nice story and a nice reasoning behind it. But you'll always find a pot of tea on no matter where you go. If you go to someone's house, they will make you tea without even asking. You know, you'll drink it like 5 times a day. It's totally normal, which adds up to a lot of sugar if you're not careful. But yeah, that's kind of the history behind it. So the mint tea is the most popular, but then you also find, especially in the winter time, they make a tea with a bunch of different like wild herbs that are mixed, especially in the mountain regions of Morocco. So it could be things like thyme, sage, even sometimes you'll find like verbena, trying to think of some more off the top of my head, but just like, you know, a mixture of wild herbs. And that's really nice. Thyme, of course, saffron tea in the southern regions of Morocco is pretty popular, where it's just saffron threads, which is a very expensive tea to have. Yeah, and you'll find different parts of the country have different ways of doing it. People say in Marrakesh, it's the tea is a lot sweeter than if you were in Rabat. So yeah, there's just like a wide, wide range. It's just, but it's, again, it's one of those things, whether you're in the furthest desert reaches of Morocco or like the most urban, fancy restaurant in Casablanca, mint tea is going to be there.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does optimism look like? I'm on a quest to find the people who inspire us to dream more and do more. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. I talk to all sorts of people, from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to a hairdresser on Instagram who gives out free haircuts to the homeless, from the CEOs of the world's largest companies to the comedy writer who visited the wreckage of the Titanic. I love talking to leaders, artists, authors, and eccentrics about life, leadership, purpose, mental fitness, human skills, high performance, and other curious things. It leaves me feeling wiser, more inspired, and, well, more optimistic. Because after all, this is a bit of optimism. The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look for it. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Like, what spice really defines Morocco? I know there's blends and there's different things, but talk to me about the spices, because the spices, when you walk around in Marrakesh and you see these all these beautiful spices out, but what is the Moroccan spice? I don't know, sort of like their flag.
You know, to me, what I always think of is cumin. Like, cumin is the spice that pops out to me as being super prevalent in most Moroccan food. And onions, I mean, that's not really a spice, but like onions also you find in literally almost every food in Morocco. And they're cheap, which I think it might be part of why that is.
Cumin and garlic, cumin and onion, definitely. And it was interesting because they don't really use garlic when they use onion. Is that correct? I can't remember. It was something like that.
Yes.
What's the rule?
Yes. Yeah, they don't use them together. They really like almost never use them together. It's either one or the other. And I'm not sure entirely where that comes from. It's something that I've tried to research a little bit, and it may possibly come from the Moroccan Jewish tradition because they don't mix onion and garlic. So it may be something that kind of like crossed over there somehow at some point. But yeah, never, almost never.
Which is very strange with the amount of French influence there, because the French love cooking with garlic and onions together. And it's then they don't. What French traditions do you see that are still sort of around? Or did they, when they left, they said, forget it, we don't want any of their traditions?
I think what you would see left is like bread, baguettes. They're not called baguettes here, but comère, they're called comère. And it's like the French baguette, but lighter, not as dense, not as thick. And the patisserie. So a lot of the cakes and the pastries and things like that. But I mean, the French, even though they had a big impact, like the time that they were actually in Morocco was really such a blip in the whole like lifespan of the country. that maybe it wasn't long enough really for a lot to permeate, especially when it comes to like culinary traditions.
Right. You know what I also remember very vividly? I think you took us to one, but it was one of these community ovens, these places where I guess, and it just makes so much sense to me where, you know, if the bread baker is making bread for the town or the village, and you know, there's all that residual heat, let's use it, let's keep it going. So bring your cookies, bring whatever, bake it off. And that's still something that happens in Morocco. Is that correct?
Totally. Yeah. Even in the newer communities, like newer subdivisions, newer areas of the city that are being built up, these traditional ovens are still being built into these communities, even though everybody probably has an oven at home. Such an ingrained part of the tradition. It used to be that everyone would bring their loaves from home and have them baked every day in these ovens. And that practice is dying down a little bit. Just, I think, so many more people are working and they're out of their home that it just has become like a little less practical. So they've started baking bread that can just be bought. Like they just sell it then to the bakeries where people can buy it, or they can buy it direct from the ovens. But some people still bring their bread in, or they bring pans of fish, you know, big trays of fish to be cooked, or cakes or cookies, or I bring my Thanksgiving turkey.
You do?
You can bring whatever you want. Yeah, you can bring whatever you want.
That's fantastic. So you're keeping up with some of the American traditions there. But this is amazing. I mean, I love that you found something that you love, which is food, and you created this tour guide company around this. And I love that. But now I'm sort of, now let's talk about today. What is going on in Morocco? Obviously, you know, most of these countries are all locked down. There's not any tourism probably. I don't know if you have local tourism coming in. What are you guys doing? How are you faring during this time?
Yeah, so we're actually still locked into our houses.
Really?
In Marrakesh. We're not allowed out yet. Yeah. So we just recently, on the 10th of June, they split the country into two zones. One zone where people are allowed out of their houses and they can stay sort of in their region. And the other zones where people are still supposed to be inside their homes and only going out for shopping or very specific things. And we also have only one person per home is allowed out with a permission slip. So it's a bit more severe than in other places. And hopefully we don't have a lot of cases. I think that they're very afraid of overwhelming the medical system with, if there was a major outbreak. So they've done well. We have like 204 deaths only, I think, in the country, and it's 37 million people. So that's okay. I mean, it's not okay for the people that have passed away, but you know what I mean? Unfortunately, they don't really have any plan that they've told us about when it might be opening, when international flights might be allowed back, when anything, what it even looks like. Only in the last maybe 2 weeks have restaurants been able to open for takeout or delivery options. So we're still really in the beginning stages of a recovery. There was some optimism by September, things might be sort of back to normal. I'm reluctant to agree with that. So most of what we're planning on is for next year.
Right. So you're just sort of hunkering down, probably doing a lot of home cooking right now and trying to keep the kids entertained, I guess. That's and the homeschooling, so to speak. Wow. So that's pretty amazing. And so I noticed actually just today, I don't know if you launched something online for to try to visit Morocco. Mm. What is that exactly?
Yeah. So I was trying to come up with some ideas of just ways to keep people interested in Morocco and keep hopes up and also keep myself busy a little bit since we don't, I mean, not like having kids isn't keeping me busy enough. But so the idea was I loved these choose your own adventure books when I was a kid, where you kind of read the pages and then you pick like, do you want to go to the castle or do you want to kill the villain? You know, like mm-hmm. those types of stories, you know, go to page 73. So I had this idea that why couldn't that work with Morocco? So for travel, so for people who can't leave home or can't come right now, I created this program where you can go on, you sign up, you get your boarding pass, you go to different cities in Morocco I think I have 6 or 7 up right now, and it'll grow as time goes on. And then in each city, you get to pick like 2 different activities. So do you want to have a Tangia picnic or do you want to learn about henna? So you pick one or the other. And then if you pick the picnic, for example, I give you my Tangia recipe and how to set up a picnic at home. So you can do these online activities where you learn about the place and there's videos and there's interaction. And you can take them offline. So if you've had way too much screen time, there's a book of all the activities that comes along with it, a PDF book that comes along with it. So you can try some of the things at
home. That's very cool. Very, very cool. Well, this has been a great chat. So you guys, just really quickly, I think something else that people should know if they're going to come and visit Morocco once all this lockdown is over, but it's a kingdom, right? So there's a king. And yes. I heard he just had surgery recently, didn't he? Is he okay?
He's okay, from what we know. He had a heart surgery. I guess he has a minor heart murmur, but they don't say too much. But he seems to be healthy and well, and that's a good thing. He's a pretty good leader.
Well, yeah, no, I think when we were there, we realized there's always a lot of talk around the king and what they're doing and what they're doing for the people, and it seems to be you guys are. Hopefully they're taking good care of you. I mean, hopefully this lockdown is over soon. What do you see in the future? I mean, obviously it's probably going to not be quite yet. You're going to be giving tours, but when you do get out of the lockdown, you're probably going to have to go sort of scour the streets and see who's still open and see what traditions have happened and what new things that might have come, because I think every country and everybody's learning something new right now by having to be locked down. Or everybody's thinking new ideas. And I guess, have you heard anything? Or I guess if you're still locked up now in your house, unfortunately, it's difficult to know, but it's going to be interesting to see what comes of all this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think we're definitely going to reduce our tour size. Like, we always kept smaller tours anyway, but I think we'll reduce them even more now, especially in the near future. And we have been keeping up with all of our vendors and trying to support them and as much financially as we're able to, since they're not really getting any revenue that's coming in. So we've really been trying to do what we could, what we can with that, which has been helpful, since a lot of people who had to cancel were willing to use gift certificates instead of ask for refunds. So that's really helped us keep some of our vendors afloat. So it's just going to be a project of going around and seeing who's open, who's doing what, and maybe, doing some more like kind of outside of Marrakesh things, to the mountains or to different areas that are a little more rural, just to give people, I guess it seems like people want to be away from people a little bit, like they want to be with people, but still keep some distance. So we're just looking into some different options for doing that too.
Well, I got to say, when this lockdown is over, I mean, I hope everybody listening that can go and check out Morocco Mama on her Instagram and her website. What is your website again? You'll probably say it better than I do.
Yeah, it's just MoroccoMama.com is my website. And Instagram is @MoroccoMama.
Well, I got to tell you, I hope you hope things get back to normal quickly, and love the food tour. Thank you so much for what you did for me and for my friends and my family when we were there. We got to really explore Marrakesh through food, which is most people that I travel with and my family, that's the way we like to experience the world as well. I do try to hit the museums every once in a while, though. You got to at least tell people you stepped foot in there, at least take a picture. But, well, thanks so much.
I should give it a chance.
Exactly. Well, Amanda, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was really, really wonderful. And I'm wishing all the best to you and your family, and everybody staying safe and healthy.
Thanks so much, Mark. And the same to yours.
Podcast update this week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.